So hello all.
So welcome in the new year 2024. I hope you enjoy your holidays and were absorbed into the texts, the last two weeks. Okay, so we will continue. Like always, is there a very, very urgent question which haunts you since days or weeks? If not, then also the question of administrative questions. So I think we have this and then two more, and the last will then be the written examination. And as I told you, it's always that the slides, the PowerPoint folders, this, I will always make the questions out of the folders. Yeah, so the folders will be your basic literature to prepare the written examination, and of course you should always look into the text which are mentioned on the folders. Okay. So that is the basic material, and of course I have uploaded on Moodle now, and also you can and share it with you the audio files of the lectures, which are recorded, and please. In former times, I always shared them openly on the internet, but now it became more difficult because people are really trying to find something, one sentence which you said in a certain way in all the many hours. So I would ask you to treat it confidentially within the course and not put it on the internet. Usually, I always attend many of my lectures on philo take of my colleague Rachowitz. Okay, if there is no administrative question concerning the examinations, then I can continue and start with the text which we had. So just to remember, because it's 2 weeks, 2 weeks have gone in between. So we had three big steps in time. So we started with the reading of the heart in the Rig Veda, which is approximately 3,500 years in the past. Then we went to the Upanishads, which is approximately between 700 and 200 before our times. And now we have started at the end with Kashmir Shaivism, which is about, and say, between 8th and 12th century, there was the peak of Kashmir Shaivism, which is a tantric tradition of philosophy. And it is very famous also, not only because many has told you that many say Abhidhinagupta, the master of this tradition, who was a philosopher and a practitioner at the same time, so many say that he's probably the second most influential philosopher in the classical ancient history of philosophy after Shankara. And even Shankara has been said that at the beginning he was in the 9th century visiting Kashmir. So that is there is quite evidence that he has even had a contact with Kashmir Shaivism. So the most in this is like, Shankara is like a little bit like Kant and Aristotle together for the Indian philosophy. So he was really very, very influential. And so this tradition is very much connected in a certain way with one of the most important classical traditions of ancient Indian philosophies. And it is for this context also very important, not only because it is probably the most distinct tradition for aesthetics. Yeah? So we have one of the most differentiated forms of reflections of Indian aesthetics in this tradition, but also, and this is quite obvious, you have Shiva, you have tantrism, you have aesthetics, so you have the sensual experiences. Therefore, it is quite obvious that it's also one of the most distinguished philosophies of the heart. And many think that there we find probably the most complex articulation of the ancient philosophies of the heart. This is why I bring it in here now. This is also what Müller Ortega, the one book which I have uploaded for you, says in the Tragic Heart of Shiva. I quote, "We shall see this process at work in great detail in the non-dual Kashmir Shaiva texts. When we turn to these texts, it will become apparent that all of the earlier meanings continue to operate even as a new dimension of ultimacy is added to the symbol." So this is what Müller Ortega says. So in a certain way, Kashmir Shaivism, what we heard about Rig Veda and Upanishad, is in a certain way culminating here in the symbol of the heart in the tradition of Indian philosophy. And of course, this is always this interesting term of alteration in Indian philosophy, Tara, iteration, that repeating is never just stereotypical repetition of the past, but it is repetition difference to quote Deleuze. Yeah? So it's always, how do you create a difference, as you can say beautifully in the English language, by repeating difference. Yeah? So it's not that, like in modernity in Europe, if you want to have something new, you have to go beyond the traditional way of throw it away. Yeah? So it's like ex nihilo. We start entirely new. Yeah? This is more the European way of what it means to create something new. In Asia, it's very clear that through repetition, you create something new. Of course, not through a simple stereotype repetition, but through anukara, mimesis, but a mimesis, as is said, that is creative. Yeah? So when we speak in Europe usually of mimesis, of repetition, of mimetic gesture, we interpret this as a conservative gesture. But it is very, in the Natya Shastra, it is explicitly said at the very beginning that repetition always has something artful. So you repeat in a creative way, and you are not just repeating the past as it has been. Yeah? So this is what Deleuze, of course, in Europe then brought in the 68s, typically, that we have to go back but repeat differently. So it's not, this is another way of alluding to the past. So it's not get rid of your past, but repeat it creatively. So you are not just repeating it, but as he says, a new dimension is always added. And you find in a certain way this concept of mimesis, of repetition, of iteration. Yeah, Latin word iteration is really the Sanskrit word itara, where you have it as Derrida also says in Limited Link. He's one of the rare moments where Derrida quotes Sanskrit and where he says, you know, the whole logic of what I'm thinking is the Sanskrit word itara, which means repetition as a form of alteration. Yeah. So and it has exactly this double meaning, itara. So it can mean you transform something, you alter it, or by repeating it differently. Yeah, so that is itara iteration. So it's not just mechanically stupid repetition of the past. But very important, and what I always bring here is that this is not so strange in Greek culture also, because mimesis in Aristotle, a very important term for the art discourse, not just in Indian philosophy, but of course everybody who knows the tradition thinks of Aristotle and ancient arts when you hear the word mimesis. And Aristotle there often uses the word prothesis. And I think prothesis is exactly the beautiful word. It's the prothese, but in the way of you are adding a surplus in a certain way to something which is there. Yeah? So the Greek word is not surplus, but in a certain way it's prothesis. So you have a thesis and your prothesis is adding something, giving some access, some surplus toward what is already there. So it becomes prothetic, means it becomes creative. Yeah? So mimesis, a prothetic mimesis in Aristotle, is an artistic mimesis. It's a mode of creation through imitation and repetition. So repeating indifference or repeating different. And this is exactly what Müller-Tegger says about the Kashmir tradition. This is really, it is a creative repetition of the entire history of the heart in Indian philosophy. So if I overemphasize, this is his thesis in the book at the very beginning. I quote the second phrase. It is precisely in those portions of Abhinavagupta's writings that we may term Kaula. So Kaula, I have to add some words. Kaula means family, means grouping. Yeah. And this is one of the big traditions in the Kashmir Shaivism. So there is one tradition, the Ashana, that is called Kaula. And here Müller-Tegger says, it is interesting because Abhinavagupta, this big master, tantric master, who wrote a lot. So he was not just practicing tantra, but he was also writing a lot about. And he said that he was the one who was so important because he took several traditions which existed at that time in a certain way and created a synthesis out of these traditions. And one of these traditions was Kaula, the Kaula tradition in Kashmir. So it's only some very small context to this one. So what he says, it is precisely in those portions of Abhinavagupta's writing that we may term Kaula, that we find the heart appearing most frequently as a symbol for the ultimate. It is in this lineage that Abhinavagupta claims to have been enlightened. So he says, it's exactly there where, in this tradition where the heart is so prominently the center of the scriptures, it is exactly this tradition in which it is said to have been had a tantric enlightenment, became the master of this tradition. So we are in the 10th, 11th century of our coming. So he then, this is still Müller-Tegger, the Triadic Heart of Shiva, quite a long book if you have watched or looked into the PDF. So I have only some very basic passages taken out of this book. And here he says, so I will not read it because it's too long, but this is at the beginning in a certain way his summary of the introduction of the entire book. And he, in a certain way, now claims that why is Kashmir Shaivism suddenly became the philosophy, or emphasis of the heart in Indian philosophy, because it sees the heart as three principles. Yeah? There is also one of the traditions called Trika, which the Trika school, which means the school of the three. Yeah, there are also the triadic heart, it's the Trika school. And he says, how do we have to think this trinity in a certain way? That this trinity is a trinity of three modes of how the heart functions. And this is in a certain way the heart of this tradition, the core of this tradition. And he says, on the first, it is Anuttara Tattva, it is the principle of that which cannot be surpassed anymore. So Anuttara means there is no beyond. So it's really the last beyond where there is no beyond anymore. Yeah, very again with Deleuze, very close to how Deleuze does define the Spinoza's thought of immanence, because Deleuze exactly says, it is the one plane which has no plane above it anymore. It's the Anupara, you could say. It's the last plane, because from this plane there is no more any ascent possible. And what is important, and I think I read right now, I read a very interesting book over Christmas, where there is where somebody is working on the relation of Aurobindo and Deleuze, in a certain way, and he says that Deleuze is so important because Deleuze, in a certain way, and he's one of my big favorites in European philosophy, as you can easily see from what I'm saying, that Deleuze was really, in that way, he was great because he saw that this plane of immanence itself has to be solved as virtue. And this is quite a big thought, because saying that the ultimate, which cannot anymore be transcended, which is usually the word to go beyond something, which cannot be transcended, has to be thought as being a virtual plane. That means it's a plane of possibilities. This makes the last plane open. If I think this is a fact, I'm, to say it hard, in a fascist thinking of this Anuttara. If I say that plane is virtual, it is opening myself, and it is not the closure as Derrida would have it. It's not closing me up to a clear, final thing, but on the contrary, it is opening an infinite field. So I think this is a very so there is an Anuttara tattva, and this is the key term here is Anuttara tattva, that is the principle of the ultimate, which cannot be overcome. So what he says now, the word in Kashmir Shaivism for this plane of immanence is the heart. So when I think of what is the ultimate, the answer of this tradition, it is a plane of the heart. So that is what Milarepa is saying. So it's the object, in a certain way, of your efforts. It's the goal, or however we would say. But goal is very dangerous term, because it makes it so teleological, as if you would reach that plane, you would be at the end. Telos, goal. Telos means end, from the word. So if you come into this plane of immanence, you have reached the goal. And that's exactly the wrong idea of Anuttara in my interpretation, because this is the goal that opens a whole new world in a certain way. And that opens infinite possibilities in a certain way, which you see. So you are at the end of an opening, but you are not at the closure of an end, which would be the very dangerous idea of having an eschatology, as if you ask me in your email, where you come to an end and then you have the Hegelian discussion, what is after the end, post-histoire, as we have. So it's okay, now you are ready, now you sleep, or what? So you are now in heaven and you are enjoying your pleasures there, and there is no growth, there is nothing anymore interesting going on, you have reached end. So that would be a telos or an anuttara that I would call dangerous, or wrong even. Because the anuttara does not mean I'm going to a definite end, where now I am resting and just looking back to how I came to where I am. But in a certain way, this is a certain way of opening that takes place. And I think there Deleuze is really important, fighting against a fascist way, as he would say, of understanding the ultimate and the Anuttara as being an end that is now the end for forever. And so. No, the opening of Anuttara brings a field of infinite possibilities. possibilities, as Deleuze says. And in a certain way, that's exactly also what you read in many of these. So they would say, okay, and that's a dimension of the heart. That is the speciality of David. So if you all have this opening, and what you see then is in a certain way, your heart open and you see a dimension of the heart. Yeah, and that's in a certain way, of course, the goal, but it's the goal to reach that opening. So it's the object, the first is the reality of the heart as Shiva, he says. So this would be the ultimate dimension of the heart, which the tantric sadhanas, the sadhaks of tantric yoga would try to approach this goal of this opening. So that is the third. So it's in a certain way the end, the goal, the principle of the ultimate. But the second level, he says, is that it's not just the goal in Kashmir Shaivism. So we are not trying just to reach the heart of Shiva, instead of the ultimate reality. But they would say, how can you come to this place? And the answer of Kashmir Shaivism, by opening your heart. So it's not just the ultimate dimension of the heart, but you can never, they would say, come by just reflecting on concepts to this opening. You, in order to come there, you have to open your heart. And it's the heart that is the path or the technique or the method is a Greek word and comes from methodos, and methodos is the path, the way. So a method is something that brings you on a path, literally. It's not just we have technique, but it is the passing, as Heidegger would say. So the method is the being on the way toward. And so the heart is not just, oh, I want to reach the heart of Shiva, but your heart, in a certain way, is the passing toward that reality in this tradition. So it's not just the ultimate reality, but it's also the method. And the Greek, again, hodos means way. So it's to find a way, and you are coming in aporias, for example. When you read Greek philosophy, this does not have, you have just a mental not understanding, an apori, but you, there is no way anymore. You are struck, you don't find any way, it's a dead end. Yeah? That is method in the Greek ancient philosophy. From the words, there is no path anymore. You know, we are at the dead end. This is aporia. There is no way out, as we say. There is no way out of it anymore. And this is where they would say, so what is creating that path is not just that you want to see the heart of Shiva, but you have to open your heart in order to create that path. Yeah, and it cannot happen without this opening of the heart. So that is the second, it's not just the object, the goal which you want to reach, but it's also method. And at the end, Müller Ortega says, even this is not enough because it's triadic. And it's triangular. It's a way of Trinity, but it has not a lot to do with Christian Trinity, I think, as it is usually thought in the tradition. But it is also the realization. So it's not that you want to go toward the heart of Shiva, if they would say, with opening your heart. But if you reach the goal and the opening of Anuttara takes place, it is a realization of your heart. So you have a triadic way, and this, Müller Ortega said, is the triadic heart of Shiva, that in a certain way, the heart here becomes a kind of triadical trinity thinking in which the heart is the goal, the path, and the realization of the goal in itself. So it has almost in a Hegelian way these three steps, of synthesis. So that is the thing. What he would claim. I've given you some literature remarks also at the end in the other PDFs which I've uploaded. Yeah. So again here, I don't want to go too deep in the first. Here you have, this is the kind, one of the rare books I said where I quote Swami. All these others are more scholars, or most of them are scholars. So this is somebody who would say, so he brings this together. We have the images there, you always have to think of them. He will bring this together to the very famous tantric topic of the Kundalini in a certain way. And this sounds also very Deleuze. Just wanted to say this is really nice. Deleuze would have written it in the way, because here they say in the Trika school, they say in a certain way they distinguish between three forms of Kundalini. So there is one Kundalini called the Para Kundalini, which is the highest Kundalini, and then it is not experienced by yogins. This is very interesting, because in this school they would say the classical yogis of Indian traditions, and when you say yogi, the schools of yoga are usually Samkhya yoga. Yeah, in Indian philosophy, that you have Patanjali yoga. Yeah, and they often allude in the text to Patanjali. But they would say the classical Indian tradition of Samkhya yoga, which is very important and orthodox tradition of Indian philosophy, this knows only 25 tattvas. Yeah? They don't know the other 11 principles. This is new in tantrism, that they added to the 25 principles of the yogis, the jnanas, those who know, they call them, they know that beyond these 25, they are absolutely right according to this tradition. So Patanjali yoga is absolutely right, but it's not fulfilled because it does not know 11 other principles which do exist according to that. So they make a distinction in this tradition usually between somebody who is a yogi, who knows the first 25 principles, and somebody who is a jnana, somebody who knows, agnostic in a certain way, Robin would say, which would mean that they know all the 36 principles. I cannot go too deeply into this, but this is why they say in a certain, they can only experience lower forms of the Kundalini for them, and the Kundalini, of course, is this very important in tantric philosophies. It is the snake that is coiled. We had it already in the Rig Veda, so in the Mula Prakriti, in the root matter, there is a snake like coiled, and from there it erects. So the whole pictures which I gave you are in the great Kundalini pictures there. Yeah, so this erection of the lower ocean, which you have here. So in tantric philosophy, this is Kundalini, which just means the enrolled. So from the word, it just means it's something that is enrolled, it's matter, but matter as it is involved and has to evolve. Again, it sounds very diverse. Sounds almost like a copy of Deleuze in philosophy, or Deleuze in philosophy, copy of this older ancient tradition. So it is matter, but in the virtual state of being enfolded, not becoming explicit, or which would be mean for them to become phallic and be black and have this vertical expansion suddenly. That's no more an ocean, a plane, but it becomes a stick that is erected. And they, again, these are cosmic principles and cannot reduce to human sense. if we take this text seriously. So these are cosmic principles. So every woman who is walking in this room has a phallus. Yeah? This is not something that would be owned by men, human men. These are cosmic principles. And it's the principle of erection. And we have this strongly as human beings, as I said, because humans are all erected beings. Die haben sich aufgerichtet. They are aufrecht, and they would call it they are erect in a certain way. So they have this kundalini, yeah, which of course is strongly female connoted in the tradition. So cannot exist in present, this is only experience at the time of death, yeah. This is also interesting, of course, for those who are interested in the philosophy of death. Then they would say, there is such a parakundalini, this is a form of matter, we could say, that circulates so quick that we, with our bodies, cannot experience it. It's too fast. It's matter that is much too fast for us, so that we cannot experience this with our human body, because our human body would in a certain way collapse immediately if it would come with this big, too strong or directly in contact with this quick matter. So we have to do as in Deleuze, we have this theory of infinite speed, as Deleuze often alludes. So what would be if, and there are quite a lot, philosophers who were reflecting on the question, what would be if light would not be the quickest form of material expansion, but what would be if there would be a plane in which matter even drives on infinite speed? So you come to very absurd, and we have this as a quite big discourse. we would have very think. That light for us is very quick. Now, as I always say, when I say 21, 1 second, the light went 7.5 times through my finger across the globe. So if I would have to look that the light is going out here and comes here back, I would have to say, it's a reference 16. Probably I was too slow. I cannot even express it because the light is quickly coming around the globe from here to here that I can say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Probably it was 7.5 times I would have to really be in order to have how quick it moves from here. So for us, when I see my speech, it is quite quick what light is doing. But what would be if there would be more subtle matter, yeah, which is out of our reach of at the moment of can prove these things, but we have a lot of physical theories which are questioning a lot of these matter things we have now in the most advanced physical theory, not only negative matter, but we have negative energy, as some of you mean. Probably no, etc. So the Deleuzean question was always already, what would be if something would even have infinite speed? Then you could say, so probably this ray of the sun took 10 billion years from our Earth to some region of the galaxies. Yeah? And now you can just do the experiment. And this, I think this is the big thing of analytical philosophy, where I'm a little bit jealous about Anglo-Saxon philosophy, that they have a good point, they are allowed to do crazy thought experiments. And they take them seriously. I think this is something we should more emphasize also in continental philosophy. And that we are allowed to do very crazy experiments. Yeah. Of thinking. And think, for example, if this takes 10 billion years, this ray of light that goes through the cosmos, if I would have the possibility to run after this ray on infinite speed. What would happen? What could I do right now? So it takes 10 billion years, yeah? But I have infinite speed. So where could I be right now? Yeah, so I could be in front of this ray and say, hello, you are coming, yeah? Or if it is 100 billion of years, I could be there and could say, hello, I see you coming the next 10 billion years, you are coming to this place where I am already right now. So we come to very strange paradox if we think through the question of velocity, of speed. And in Indian philosophies, you have very often these things that we have wheels, they are so quick in forms of energy that they are much quicker even than what we today would call the speed of. Yeah? And then they create strange possibilities for us. Yeah? That this would mean that I could be before everything that has a certain speed. I could already be there, for example. So whatever speed it has, I could be in the moment before that thing, and so on. But there are many of these paradoxes, and in a certain way, Pada Kundalini, he would say, you have something, you have such quick matter with such a high speed, that in a certain way, our body would not be capable to hold it. Yeah, it's too quick for us. In a certain way, we would burn, probably, if we would come directly in contact with this quick energy. Yeah, and that is something where they say, in their mythological form of thinking, that the only moment where human beings can suddenly experience these high speed energies is the moment of death. So when you die and you grow your slow body, yeah, this is where when they say gross body, they also have not just it's a massive body, but it's also a slow. So yeah, these particles, even if they're very quick, yeah, so if we have electromagnetic speeds in our bodies, yeah, where they are quite quick, yeah, thousands of neurons are acting together on a quite high speed, they would say, oh, this speed is still very slow compared to the speed we are speaking of when we speak of particles. These are much quicker processes. Yeah? And therefore we are not really able to grasp them or fix them in a certain way. So, and this is what they would say, this is what one can only experience in death when the slow parts of our body fall away. Yeah? It's not only that the gravity puts these slows down. The tamas, the gravity principle, slows down the speed of matter, and when it slows down the speed of matter, we have gross body, massive bodies, in a certain way. Yeah? But if when you die, this gravity has no more a hold or a grip on you, and the much quicker energies, and you are freed in a release, and there is a way you suddenly can experience this paracord. Yeah? And this is the heart of Shiva. Yeah? So this is one of the things. So this is a speed measure and which we can so not really, and therefore it's not so important for us as human beings when we live in the moon. Yeah? Because we are on much slower, much more, we are in a universe that is much more in the hold of gravity. Yeah? So gravity is a much stronger principle in our universe in which our bodies are part of. Yeah? So that is okay. But I did not really, I did it much too excessive now. I wanted to go on this one. But this is so Deleuze, so who reads Deleuze? One can really see that this is really strange because I don't know that Deleuze read any of these texts, new any of these texts. French philosophers in Europe, and Deleuze died in 1998. So not so, so, yeah, he died when you were born. Okay, so I go to the next passage here. Abhivinayagupta, quote, Abhivinayagupta makes this precise point in stating that only when the lotus of the heart has been opened by the descent of energy will the truth be revealed. Not even the most acute reasoning powers in the world could produce this revelation. Once the heart has been opened, continues Abhivinayagupta, this curvy thought can penetrate ever more closely to the ultimate. Also this is what I already said, so that this is not just a, it's the path, it's the method. So it's not just that you have a heart, this heart is pulsating in a certain way, it's an organ in your body, but here in a certain way you have the idea that the heart is, yeah, you really, you can take a little bit Heidegger, yeah? Here is the Heidegger, you always have to distinguish, which I usually do not do, between the good and the bad. So when he says, he is in his late philosophy using the word Bewegung, the German word Bewegung. Yeah? And of course in the word moving, Bewegung in the German word, there is the path. Yeah? So the emotion is not just moving on a fixed road, but the emotion, emotion, bewegung, yeah, the emotion, the bringing into movement, is in itself a form of pathing. It is creating channels and ways, and is not just moving on chambers anyway. Yeah, it is bewegend, the Heidegger said in his late philosophy. So in German you can play with this. So it's not just a movement, but the movement is also a passing, a creating of a path. So if we many times move here and up, I will have to trace this and then if I would do this now for 100 years, there would be a path, yeah, in the on the floor. Yeah? So my movement is passing a path.
Which text would Heidegger have the name?
These are the late texts of the 50s. Yeah, very late Heidegger. But I would have, I think in Holzwege you have one of the thing, but you can write me again an email and ask him, then I can give you, I have to remember now, so I'm not 100% sure. I would guess that if you find this old text, some in Holzwege and some in Wegmarken. This was a collection of essays from late Heidegger, and they have been given out as a book. So I think there these essays are, should be also some of these essays from the very late Heidegger where he plays with the book. But I try to remember now, if you send me an email I can look it up and tell you for sure where you can find. Yes, so that is, so das Herz is not just going on channels and paths, but it is a passing. It is by moving, creating channels and paths. Yeah? So it is a passing, something like this. And this is exactly method. And this is what he says here. So it is the instrument with whom you create the path in order to go to Amitabha. Yeah. It's the method, as the Greek would say. So this is this. I'm very quick today.
So I think we have made already three or four slides, yeah, not one. Huh? Applause.
Genau, here we have the same thing. Also, this is a repetition anyway of the same thing. Probably I go the descent of the energies. Here again, I hope that my simple diagrams can help you a little bit. That I said, I don't have this picture here now, but when you think of the very first picture, I always said there is one level when you erect, you ascend. Yeah, they would say. Yeah. So in the very moment there is an Aufrichtung, in this moment you go from down up. So when animals erected, as they would say, they went up, as we say. Yeah. So there is always this ascent of nature, as they would say. So there is always this direction of going from the flat, the yonic female place, to the phallic vertical dimension. Yeah? And this is the movement, the upward movement, as they would say. Yeah? In evolution, you have a kind of upward movement, yeah? Where you have the development of this principle, and they now stand up. And so, but this is only one direction, because, and this is again, sorry, but I have to say Heidegger is here very close, because what Heidegger calls the care, and we said already, but this is in turn always a descent of the other side. So when we stand up, something is coming down. Yeah? This is not a one-sided thing. So the phallus is not just going up, but the phallus going up is going down the ladder from the other side. Yeah? So it's always an ascent and a descent of the energy. Yeah? So when we develop new levels, we go up to them, but on the other side, this is a coming down of that level into our body in a certain way. It's very dangerous philosophically to use these terms, but it's not totally wrong, I would say. Yeah, so in a certain way, what we call embodiment, they would call an ascent and a descent. So the spirit comes down and the body is lifted up. Yeah? And this goes hand in hand. Hand in hand is quite good. It goes care, as Heidegger would say. So whenever you have a direction that goes into this upward, from earth to heaven, you have a counter, and this is the same energy. Yeah? This is not that you have one thing and the other, but the going up in Heraclitus, I think I quoted already, you have the famous fragment where he says, the way up is the same as the way down. I think that ancient Greek had very similar ideas. This is, we have lost this tradition. Yeah? But they were in a certain way global. They had a lot of similarities, yeah, on the globe at these times. Because in Heraclitus you find really this fragment, for example, where he really, this could be directly a passage from a tantric text. You will find hundred of texts where you have exactly the way up is the same as the way down. But you find exactly the same sentence in our context. Yeah? So that is obviously an experience what they have, that, and I think it's connected to the breathing systems. A lot of these traditions were trained in certain breathing practices. And my answer would be that if you are training certain breathing techniques, you are starting to experience exactly that you are lifted up and something is coming down. Yeah? So I think that's a theory. But I think this has to do a lot with breathing techniques. Yeah? And we had these techniques not only in Asia, but we have these techniques, as you know very well, in ancient Greek philosophies as well.
There is even the discussion whether Plato and Aristotle have taken drugs.
But these are really a serious scholarly, strong scholarly. And they are also thinking of certain plants which they had at the times of Plato and Aristotle, which they have probably consumed. So because we always take this to, oh, we are the rational European. And then there is this exotic ancient philosophy. I think probably Plato and Aristotle were more crazy, more freaks than we today have a classical image of these people created. I would at least let this question open. So that is the descent of energy. So we see finding 100 of things. Yeah? But you never have to say, when you say descent of energy, it's at the other hand the ascent of the body. So the body evolves and uprights, it evolves, and something they experience is at the same time on the other side coming down. So that's a kind of circular movement which you have. And this is, as I had a whole axis. In my diagram, if you go back to the very first pictures, you have it that this is a whole axis that goes through all the planes. So this is not true for them for one plane, but so this is not true for one status of evolution, to translate in more European. But this is true for all steps in time. Time is always a descent and an ascent at the same time. And both go hand in hand. So that is something for me very crucial. So it's the whole axis. In a certain way, not just one thing. With one slice, one shift, Geschichte. It goes through. You wanted to say something?
Did you say time is an axis that goes up and down?
Yeah, in a certain way, you could even say, otherwise you cannot understand their time concepts, that in a certain way, this is the secret how time works for me. It's the measure of time. So, what are human beings? They have erected certain planes of beings. And that defines their step with their evolutionary role within the cosmos. Because they have not developed all the planes, then they would be a god. So they have some planes which they have to develop in the future, therefore they experience future as the planes which have not yet been erected, as they would say. So they not yet became vertical. They are not yet embodied as part of their body, but they lay in the back. They sleep there in the background. And therefore, it is in a certain way the what time, but time not just as a formal concept, but as becoming. It's not just you can distinguish between time as a scale that measures this and this and that, but it is time as the form of becoming. Of werden. So, and that time is nothing without the material showing up of the things. If I have just a formal principle or paradigm, I always have the conflict between form and matter. I'm just abstract form. Time is an abstract form. But here in becoming, time is a real principle that evolves. It's a form of becoming. Time, the English word is very beautiful. Becoming. It's the being in its coming. German, zu kommen. Yeah? That is what is still in the background of the heart, as they would say. Then I go away from Müller Ortega, so you have the PDF, and go to one Indologist. She is Austrian, Bettina Balmer. So she was quite important because she has a research center in Benares, and I visited this also, and so to have a personal contact also to her, and she has translated Vijnana by Rava. This is one of the most important texts of this tradition, Vijnana. We heard already, we had it with Aurobindo also. He called it Gnostic plane, yeah, Vijnana. Usually you have this term mostly in Buddhist texts. So it's a very strong concept which you find in many, many Buddhist texts. But you find it here also in the Tantric tradition, you find it by Aurobindo in a certain way, as the next plane that the humanity has to evolve in Aurobindo. And here you have the Vijnana Bhairava. This is, Bhairava is usually the terrible form of Shiva. So Bhairava is one of the names of Shiva, and it's usually the Shiva which people are afraid of. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Because he takes away all in a certain, he takes away and burns all, now almost all. Have to change in a more Christian terminology, but I would call it in the yoga tradition the obstacles. And so, since we have a lot of obstacles, he is the god of crisis. This is a word which is circulating quite a lot right now, because in a certain way burns away the things which we should get rid of, yeah, in a certain way. So nobody likes him really, because he is bringing you always again in your next crisis. In a certain way. Probably this is a good, he's the terrible also. But of course here what he is, Vijnana from the word means recognition, knowing, yeah. So what he brings knowledge, but that means he has to get rid of all your ignorance. So he's so terrible because he has to free us from all ignorance. And since we are full of ignorance, he brings us in one crisis and the next crisis and the next crisis, because it's so difficult for us not to be ignorant in a certain way, not be in the grip of the hands of avidya, which is the root of all obstacles in philosophy, almost in every tradition. So, but we are here, so Vijnana Bhairava, so Bhairava is one of the names and attributes of Shiva. We know already in this tradition the last ultimate reality, and he, in a certain way, this is the book on the knowledge, you can say the knowledge of Bhairava. Yeah, so he brings this knowledge and he is that knowledge. And Bettina Balmer, she has translated the German version, therefore I have here the German and translated with deep L. So help me to give you also those who would prefer the English. This is the English translation, deep L, of this German original text. This I have, by the way, uploaded on Moodle. Only some pages from the books and in the obligatory literature folder and in the non-obligatory I have uploaded you a whole translation of the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra. So you have this also on Moodle. So the German translation means, because we are still here on the speaking on the heart. Schließlich, I quote German, schließlich bedeutet Madhya. Yeah, so Madhya is, so the book is then, probably I have to say something. context. So the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra is a book in this tradition which is a little bit like the Yoga Sutra from Patanjali, a book of practices. Yeah? And it teaches you meditation, dharana. Yeah? And it has, I don't know by heart now the whole number, but 200, I don't know whether you know how many meditation practices are.
180,
yeah. Thank you. So about 180 meditation practices, which are for those who are trying to make the tantric tradition their life form. Yeah, I would. This is how I would translate sadhana. So you make it a practice for your life. Yeah? And so there are 180 yogic techniques which you should train, usually with a master, and which will bring you the knowledge of Bhairava. Yeah? So they bring you the vijnana of Bhairava. So these are tantric meditation. So, by the way, is there any sex meditation? Is there any?
Yeah, there is.
I don't remember.
Yatra yatra manasushti tatra tatra eva dharaya, which is usually where the mind finds satisfaction, there you should meditate. So in the commentary, they usually say this is a description of the, for example, sexual pleasure.
Yeah.
You can meditate for.
Exactly. But you see, these are meditation practices, yeah? And some have a context to sexuality, but usually it's not about, she says, it's about breathing, yeah? She says, so the first techniques are exactly about pranayama, about breathing. Then there are the second, I think, Palmer is saying, and this is the word madhya, is about, and she's saying not madhya should not be the German word, concentration does not give a good translation anymore, because when we say concentration, we don't have the centering there anymore strongly. And she therefore prefers the English term in the German tradition of, we should call it not just concentration, there is centering in concentration, but we have, if we hear the word, we are usually not thinking of centering anymore in the German language. But the English language still has it, because they would translate it with concentration is a form of center. Yeah? So I can center, I can concentrate on a chair, on a breath, I can concentrate on an idea. And this is a forms of centering yourself. Yeah? And the term for this is centering, is madhya. It brings you, these are meditation techniques which try to bring you into your center. Yeah? So it's not just you are meditating on a candle, something like this, but you are meditating on the candle in order to gain access into your center, madhya. So it tries to center you through that meditational concentration technique, yeah, on the breath, different forms of centering practices, different forms of, so one is breathing, one is madhya, the concentration in this literal sense, one is shunyata, yeah, so it's you, when you are concentrating and you come into the middle, then you will experience emptiness, yeah? An open space. Yeah? This is also why I said anuttara is not just you have reached the goal, but you have reached the goal that an opening takes place, and not the closure. Yeah? So this is a book about this about tantric yoga practice. I would say. Yeah, and it tries, of course, that you understand that you have, as Aurelio would say, you have something agnostic understanding of Bairam.
Yeah, that is why you are doing this if you are starting a tantric practice. So Madhya is centering middle to how centering techniques to bring you into the middle. Yeah, the meeting. Yeah. How do you find your middle? Schließlich bedeutet Madhya natürlich auch das Herz als die mystische Mitte. So that is now very important in the context of our seminar, that this term or these meditation practices which try to bring you into the middle, to center you, are exactly practices of the heart, because the heart is Madhya. It is the middle. Yeah? So that is one of the crucial descriptions through so many traditions in Indian philosophy, that whenever you find the middle between two, you have reached the heart. Yeah? And I told you, so think of the one painting there. We have this middle, of course, in our bodies. We spoke last time about the Bindu, yeah, which is the middle in the eyebrow between the two eyes. So I claimed that they could in several texts call the Bindu to be the heart of the two eyes, because it's in the middle. And the whole stick, as they would say, so the whole Wirbelsäule, of course, is in the middle, and it brings together the binary impulses of the right hand, of the left hand. All right left is centered in the middle, in a certain way. And therefore, this middle X, which I have read there in the diagrams, is always the bodily center of the heart. And then we say that we do the upper and the lowest point of your stick, of the Wirbelsäule, then you come into the anatomical heart. And then we also said that when we two speak together, in order to speak in a cordial manner, we both would have to become ecstatic. We would have to come out of ourselves and enter the middle of our dialogue. If I listen to you, I am starting to come out of myself and enter the middle between you and me. So again here, the heart is not, of course, just the center as an organ, but it is really here whenever we enter a dialogue, a real dialogue, in which one listens and responds to the other, we are becoming cordial. For them, this is not metaphorical, but literal. Yeah, we make it easy. Oh, that's a metaphor. And then we are ready, finished. Yeah? So that's it, okay. They think in metaphors. So the real heart is this boop, 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 the brainer. And then when we come into a dialogue and have a real dialogue, I'm with you, I'm in you, you in me. So we have this listening and hearing about each other. Then we realize a heartful relation among each other. And if we come not to the middle, we will have to start problems, because there will be no dialogue. We will speak about each other without the heart. Yeah? And it's a question whether these are just metaphors. Yeah? So if we have all these war things, where is the dialogue? Where is the heart? In war, the heart has gone. Because we are no more in a dialogue, we are enemies. Being in an enemy warfare, an enemy is always losing your heart. And this is heartbreaking.
And it is very literally heartbreaking. For a lot of people, it's very, very seriously heartbreak. So using the middle is a very also social-political problem. Yeah? So it's not just, oh, these are these ego people trying to find sanctuary methods to be in the middle because they want to be neoliberal self-realization. I want to realize the peak of my neoliberal possibilities. Yeah? So go away, you are in my way. I want to be stronger. I want to do happier. But this means that we lose the dialogical dimension of the heart. That we come out of ourselves. And that is the centering message all about. So how can we come out, or to say more contemporary philosophy, how can we become relational? Yeah? And not being caught in our narcissistic self. Yeah? As we see us in the mirror. And as I see myself in the mirror, I end at the surface of my body. And there I incorporate, as I said many times in Lacan's sense, the mirror picture of my life. I have that narcissistic approach toward myself. But in this narcissistic approach, I lose my heart. And again, in a Heideggerian sense, I can no more exist. And exist means standing out. I lose my relationality with the other. Right? And that is much more, I would say, true for what they understand to be the heart than just the anatomical organ within ourselves. But this does not mean that, obviously, if you are now in one of the war zones, your breath, your heart, will pulsate differently. It's not that the heart has nothing to do with the organ as we have. Because obviously the pulsating heart is very effective, ultimately affected by such ways of losing the heart between being able to be in a dialogue, for example, anymore. This has also its effects on the anatomic heart. But for them, I would say, this would never have made sense to reduce the concept of the heart just to the anatomic organ in our human body. Because it's strongly the madhya, it's strongly the approach to reach the middle between two. And that is. Und ohne eine Öffnung des Herzens ist keine spirituelle Entwicklung möglich. Das spirituelle Herz, die Mitte und das zentrale Bewusstsein haben mit Daten auf dieselbe Wirklichkeit, die es bei allen spirituellen Praktiken zu entfalten gibt. Bahama Patch 29. So I just took this to show that in a certain way also Balmer agrees that here in this tradition of Kashmir Shaivism, the heart starts to become really the core, the middle of this philosophy. But as we have seen, it has not at all primarily the sense of the heart means that you are Rosamunde Pilcher, you have this sensuality and this is no kitschig, no kitschig or sentimental thing. Yeah? This is the wrong heart, they would say. Yeah, if you just believe in your sentiments or something like this. This is an important, this is all about, in this book, about this madhya, this middle, because I think this is really the crucial point from where we get the philosophical understanding of what they meant with the heart. So for me, this madhya is the very core attribute of what a heart is in the tradition of Indian philosophy. And especially you see this when you practice these techniques. It's most of these 180
praxises are trying to create a center so that you are coming back into your center. Yeah? That is for me the core of these things. So this is the other passage. I have also translated it from Google, from DeepL. And therefore, I take here, this is a long one. I don't read the original German one, which you have seen before, but already the translation in English, because some of you don't know German, you say. So, and this is for me strongly a very important passage out of the Vijnana Bhairava, because this, I think, shows very nice in the praxis of meditation praxis what they really thought is the core about their concept of what the heart is and what they mean when they say the heart is. So Madhya, so the middle, the heart, the center, Madhya is first of all the in-between, the point or moment between two things, two states, two experiences, two times. Yeah? I think this is, so whenever you have two, whenever you have, to quote the verse again, a multitude, and a vielheit, a grouping, you, in a certain way, it becomes a matter of the heart, how you group the group. How do you group the grouping? That's the matter of the heart. Yeah? So you don't just have groups, but the heart is trying how to group them in a certain way. You have two, and then you try to find the middle of these two. Think also of Aristotle Mesopis. Of course, how to balance and finding the middle in Aristotelian ethics. Mesotis, so finding the middle. So I don't think that these things are so far away. So to just give you an idea, so one of the most frequent techniques that you find in tantric, but also in the Samkhya yoga traditions, so usually you start yoga not with asanas, this is European, but you start yoga with breath. Yeah? So the breathing is the key. Yeah? The breathing is, and now how does a breath work? So they would say a breath has four aspects. It has the breathing in, the pause on the top of the breath where you have a break, the Atemwende, the Pulse Answer. Yeah? So you have the Atemwende, and then you have the exhale. Yeah? So you have this break at the bottom of the Mula Bracket, of root matter. Now, when you exhale, you go back to the root matter, and there you have this break, this moment of silence, of innehalten, as we say in German. Yeah, you have this Atemwende below. When you exhale, you have this breath, and in many traditions you try to extend this breath, this moment of silence, and you go from the exhale to the inhale, and from the inhale to the exhale. So you have these four moments, you have the silence at the end of exhaling, and you have the silence at the end of inhaling, which is the top point, Bindu, Jiva Bindu, and which is the Shakti Bindu, which is the Bindu in the Mula Bracket. Yeah? And what they would say, this is a very typical exercise because it becomes cordially or heartful when I try to experience the middle between breathing in and breathing out. And that middle is in the upper and in the lower being. Yeah? In the moment of inhale, of concentration. So
So when I do, there is no inhale. This is nervous sound. Yeah? There is not enough nothingness in it, as John Cage said. Yeah? There is not enough pause in it. Yeah? So you have to extend the pause in the breathing, and there you then experience in a certain way the middle of the inhaling and the exhaling. Yeah? So this is probably one of the most typical meditation practices which you find in almost every tradition of Indian philosophy. Yeah, the pranayama technique with the four aspects of inhaling, break on the top, exhaling, break on the bottom. Yeah. And there they learn to be in the middle. Yeah.
The middle is not really as we understand the middle, but it's more of the two extremes, at least it sounds like this. It's because it's not in the middle of breathing, but in the stopping of breathing.
Because that is when we think it dualistic, you are right. We try to think it not dualistic. Look, the other very important tantric exercise that you find in many traditions, Buddhist tradition, Tantra yoga, is what is the moment before you inhale and before you exhale? So, or what is the moment before I utter a sound in speech? Yeah? There is always this silence, and in the silence you take a little bit breath. You need breath. So when I want to say something, I need breath. So there is a moment before you really breath in, but there is this one moment where you are coming from the silence to the impulse of speaking, for example, or to the impulse to breathe in, or to the impulse to breathe out. And they would say, that is a very interesting moment. You have it also in sleeping. Yeah? So the very moment before you fell, before you start to sleep, or before you awake. So they would say, centering is very much like, look how from nothingness, from emptiness, in a certain way, you start to create an emotion, a movement. Yeah? And you try to experience that movement, for example, in breathing. Yeah? So when you have this middle, the middle is the silence, the vishaga. Yeah? This is also very critical. Yeah? The last letter of the Sanskrit alphabet is, as I said, the this is the sound of the breath, of course. If I don't say something, but yeah, I have the sound, the sound has its, the breath has its own sound. Yeah? And it's certainly, and the sound is always like, and you have, this is a whole philosophy which they have. Yeah? So think also of when we are in tantric of sexuality. Yeah? They have started, yeah? This is serious study. So why do you usually produce these kind of sounds which are very much connected to the sound of the breath? Yeah? Which is the last letter of the Sanskrit alphabet, and it is written as two points. So there is not ha standing there, but there are two points. And these two points are, for example, exactly the upper, yeah, the moment of silence when you So you have the vishada, the down point, and you have the up point. Yeah? And so the simple Hauchlaut, yeah, the heart, Hauchlaut. So for example, for them it would be terrible that we had the beautiful melodic Atem in the 19th century in German, it would have an H. It would be At. And we have lost that H. Huh? How can we call Atem plötzlich Atem? We have lost the pause. We have lost the H. Huh? And they would now say, for example, if you have a sound like ah, yeah, you have always this sound, and then it goes to towards silence. And that is what they say, if you exercise this and you go from the sound to the silence, you will experience the middle. Yeah? Or if you breathe in and you see that your breath, before you start to take the breath, you're like, yeah, you make something like, but before you have this impulse, you take it from nothing. Yeah? So that impulse is coming like the sound, first, or when I say, but then first, before that verb is coming, there is silence. And you break the silence by making verb. So you can now just hear the verb, or you hear the silence and the verb. Yeah? And then you start to see the middle. That's, yeah? So if you lose the silence, you lose the middle. And that's it. And then you are just, he said, just K. Yeah. So they have a whole phonology, very sophisticated phonology in Indian philosophy. But that is so in a certain way where Dharma said, so you have to practice the middle, would really now give also very practical exercises in order to reach that goal that you create an awareness of what this middle means. So that is this in-between. It is the distance or intermediate state that belongs neither to one side nor to the other. Yeah? And this is this dialogical or relational thing. Yeah? We are never object, we are never such. But the heart is the middle that mediates between object and such, for example. And that relational affair, as I would say, means that you are entering the middle. As we in German would say, you in die Beziehung eintreten. So man wird beziehungsfähig. Yeah? And we have this very strongly as humans with humans. Yeah, so into subjective. But of course you can also enter into a Beziehung, a relation with the forest. Yeah? In a certain way. But it's the heart that makes you beziehungsfähig. Yeah? For that. So it makes your being in the world a relational affair, as I would call it. So that is very, so then you are only in the middle, yeah, for the two things. So this is this intermediate distance, which now belongs neither to the object, neither to the subject, neither to you nor to me, but to our relational affair in between. It's the relation that in a certain way creates you and me as poems of that relational affair. Yeah? And this thing you have, of course, in many, many contemporary philosophies in the European context. So how can we think relationality, or relational ontology, and we have a lot of philosophers who exactly bring this at the very topic. But I would claim that they would accept it. So if you start to think relational ontology, you are thinking exactly what we call the heart. That would be my interpretation. You try to think the middle between the two.
Okay. So I think time is over. Yes.